Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Mobrick, and today on Route 51, we enter the world of environmental ethics as we explore the relative value of job creation and environmental protection with our guest, Dale Murray, Assistant Professor of Philosophy at UW-Baraboo Sauk County and UW-Richland. Dr. Murray is in Wausau to give a lecture at 7:30 tonight in the Center for Civic Engagement Theater at UW-Marathon County. It's a lecture on the possible impact of frack sand mining on endangered species in Wisconsin, like the Karner blue butterfly, and also the impact of mining on human communities in our state. Dr. Murray's appearance is sponsored by WIPS, the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. The nation's demand for natural gas has led to an increase in fracking operations around the country, in which liquids mixed with sand from Wisconsin are pumped at high pressure deep into the ground in order to free up natural gas deposits. Fracking is controversial in the places where it occurs, and mining for frack sand has become controversial as well. The number of active frack sand mines has skyrocketed to more than 100 in our state. Our guest tonight is asking how this new, rapidly growing industry will affect endangered species like the Karner blue butterfly, when there hasn't been enough time to do the scientific research and accumulate the data for a definitive answer. By the time we study frack sand mining, will it be too late for the butterfly? So we'd like to hear from you. What value do we put on the environment, since we're talking about environmental ethics? What value do we put on job creation? How do we weigh and balance the two? If you'd like to weigh in, here's our phone number, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Dr. Dale Murray, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, why is somebody who teaches philosophy getting involved in an environmental matter like frack sand mining or the Karner blue butterfly and endangered species? Wouldn't it be better to leave those questions to scientists?
Yeah, I think that there's certainly a huge role to be played by scientists in this, but I think that there are questions of value that that scientists don't necessarily take firsthand. I think that if you're trying to figure out how it is that you can think about ethical issues and about value, intrinsic value of non-human species versus human species, you might actually look into ethical types of arguments, and you can't always just settle it by looking at empirical data.
What is environmental ethics as a field in philosophy?
Yeah, it's a good question. Environmental ethics is applied, I suppose, principles of ethics to issues that involve environmental problems. So,
okay.
for example, if you were thinking about the intrinsic value of species, one of the things that you might want to do is take a look at a particular species, and you might want to apply ethical principles and to see, so for example, human beings, many will say, either get value from the moment of conception or from certain capacities that they have, rational capacity, mm-hmm. sentience, or feeling. And then you can compare non-human species to that as well and to say, well, do these kinds of characteristics really matter at the end of the day? Some will argue that, for a non-human species, it really doesn't matter so much whether or not they have high capacities for rationality. What really matters at the end of the day is whether or not they can feel pleasure or pain, whether or not they can suffer. And that, if you look at the history of philosophy, you'll look at arguments from utilitarian philosophers such as John Stuart Mill, who really center on that particular problem, and you can try to apply it to these particular cases.
Mm-hmm. But, doesn't it come down to whether or not the environment and protection of the environment is intrinsically valuable in itself as a good unto itself, or whether or not it's valuable only insofar as it relates to human beings and benefits human beings?
Yeah, I think those are the two primary types of arguments that folks will use. And it may very well be the case that making arguments for the intrinsic value of non-human beings is going to be a really difficult chore.
Well, let's take a hypothetical. Let's say human beings were to become extinct. Right. And human beings didn't exist any longer on this planet. Wouldn't it make sense to have a clean environment and well-functioning ecosystems so that evolution could continue to occur and maybe intelligent life forms could arise sometime in the future? In that case, the environment has a value in and of itself, regardless of whether it's something that is good for human beings.
It could be, except that the interesting thing is that when you were giving the evolutionary argument, and I'm not sure if this is where you were going with it, is whether or not eventually you would get to a point where that evolution matters because you get back to human beings at some point in the future. But then
you get back to something else.
Or to something else, perhaps. And, you know, if it were back to human beings, then one could argue, well, that's just through the back door bringing in value to human beings. But if not to human beings, then maybe you're right. But then is the value placed on something about ecosystems that's intrinsically valuable anymore, or are you getting some kinds of consequence? Because if that's the case, then why go to the evolutionary argument anyway?
Or if you want to give it a theological or a religious a component, you could say, isn't there an intrinsic value to God's creation?
That's right. That's right. And in fact, a number of environmental ethicists have a background in theology or theological matters and make that kind of argument. But then this is interesting from another perspective, because if it were the case, you know, and I'll ask students about this, if it were the case, though, that that value, if it's only created by God, if it couldn't have been created by God, which they would see as, I would think, being logically fallacious because God is supposed to be omnipotent, omniscient,
right,
and all the rest, right?
Unless God doesn't exist.
Exactly. And so if that's the case, though, that seems to be that the intrinsic value comes from something about God. It's not so clear that that intrinsic value comes from the creations.
But if God doesn't exist, then
right,
the intrinsic value has to come from whatever does exist, because that's all there is.
That's right. That's right.
Who are the people who influenced your approach to philosophy and your approach to environmental questions? What are the thinkers that influenced you?
I actually think, this part of this starts to sound like, what is your favorite philosopher question?
That might have been the question.
And I don't really have a favorite philosopher. I understand that's weird. It's sort of like when you ask someone what their favorite baseball player is, usually people have a, you know, identifiable person. I really don't. There are players that I like. So I'll tell you a few players that I like, if you want to do it that way. So I think Socrates, mainly just from the kind of method of questioning and answering, has been a broad influence on my work. But I think that the work of John Stuart Mill probably has had the most impact, because
he was a utilitarian.
He was a utilitarian
and a pragmatist.
Yes, and he also, he's a very interesting person. He advocated for women's, I wouldn't say women's rights. I would say that the interests of women should be taken equally into account during a time period where no one was having any of that.
Now is he the guy who came up with the greatest good for the greatest number as a guiding ethical principle?
Yeah, and actually, I think that he sharing the role with Jeremy Bentham as two prime utilitarians, but Mill in particular looked at, and I guess this is where the environmental ethics part comes in, he also argued that really at the end of the day, the value of animals had nothing to do with their ability for language. Lots of folks during that time period said, well, look, animals can't reason because they can't really communicate very well.
Well, they were just coming out of the whole period of the rational philosophers where
That's
the ability
right.
to reason was valued above everything else.
That's right. That's right. And I think that what Mill did was to say, well, let's think about this. Why is that the case, that reason is so imperative for value. It's interesting coming from him because the greatest good for the greatest number is a feeling of mental bliss or happiness. And so he said, well, you know, how much stake do we want to put in reason itself? Maybe there's something beyond that that matters. And there's a sentimental approach. There's an empathetic human approach, too. David Hume, another philosopher, talked about this sort of empathetic approach, that you see someone suffering, and it's natural for you to want to, or at least unless there's something going on with you that isn't quite right,
right,
that you want to help them out. And this idea that feelings do matter ethically. And so I think for those reasons, I think Mill is probably the strongest influence on me as an environmental philosopher and philosopher in general.
How about people who are bird watchers, who are naturalists, who get a great feeling of joy from being in tune with the environment, in tune with God's creation? Again,
right,
if you want
right,
to get
sure.
a bit theological. And if you take that away from them, aren't you harming somebody who has the
yeah.
ability to think and the ability to feel?
That's a really interesting question. I hadn't really thought about it from that perspective, but it makes sense. And it actually may apply to the topic of the Karner blue butterfly as well, because part of the cost-benefit analysis, you know, cost-benefit analysis, usually everyone wants to focus on the monetary aspect.
How much is environmental protection worth? How much is job creation
That's
worth?
Right.
How do you balance them?
And so when you look at it...
And if you want to be crass, you know, you come down to, and say... The environmental protection is worth something because it's vital to our tourist industry.
That's right.
You know, you
That's
put a,
right.
try to put a dollar figure on it.
That's right. And I think that there are a number of folks who this goes, it really goes beyond that. And they want to say, well, when you're doing this cost-benefit analysis, what you also have to figure in, but this is the trick, how do you figure this in, right? The feelings that people have of deep connection with nature. And how do you put a price on it? Or if you don't want to talk about something as crass as price, I suppose, you could say, how do you put a value on that?
And for some people, it's a spiritual and a religious feeling. If you talk
right.
to Native Americans,
that's right.
You know, the environment is tied up with their religion.
Yes.
And you can't put a price on that.
That's right. And so then it becomes an issue of intrinsic versus extrinsic value or instrumental value. They kind of blur in that position, right? Because even if I were to say, well, these are just instrumental values, it's all about you at the end of the day. When someone charges, well, what's the difference? I mean, really, the value that I'm feeling is something that is so deep that it's completely interconnected with my spiritual nature,
mm-hmm.
right? I can't put aside, well, these are just my aesthetic values and put those in those convenient closets. And then in this other set of convenient closets, I have spiritual values. They're intertwined in an integral way. And I think a number of environmental philosophers have seen that. I think Ralston, who was a later environmental ethicist, had this kind of argument. And he said, you know, people really slam at me for not being able to come up with good arguments for the intrinsic nature of things. But hold on a second. These are really hard arguments to make, not necessarily because they can't be made. It's just that it really is difficult to parse out mm-hmm. all of these different types of characteristics that are going through at the same time.
And it's sometimes hard to find people who are receptive to your argument.
Definitely, definitely.
So let's take this background of environmental ethics, the idea that you're weighing the relative value of job creation, protection of the environment, and particularly endangered species like the Karner
right.
blue butterfly. And that's all the topic of this lecture that you're giving tonight here
that's
at
right.
UW Marathon County. 7:30 p.m., is that?
Actually, right? sorry. Yeah, it's actually at 6:30 p.m.
6:30
so
p.m.
So it's a tight turnaround
from okay,
here.
Okay.
I'll be dashing down the hallway.
I want to apologize for that. I wasn't sure, and I should have double-checked with you. It's 6:30 p.m.
6:30.
Here at the Center for Civic Engagement Theater on the UW Marathon County campus. So
correct.
And it is free, correct?
Correct, yes.
Tell us about the lecture. What are you going to be talking about?
Yeah, well, the first thing I want to talk about primarily is the prevalence of frac sand mining. And this is an issue that sort of snuck up on a lot of us, me included. It really did. And I think that if you look at the number of mine sites that were active and or processing sites, there were around five in 2007. And I heard mainly about fracking. I didn't really hear about frac sand mining at first. And it was sort of, well, what is this mysterious sort of method that you have now? And so what I want to do first is just, because oftentimes it's very easy, you'll read a newspaper and electronic newspapers now, then you sort of can read the comment sections and opinions that people have about an article or an editorial. And a number of the comments usually say things such as, well, you know, we've been sand mining for a long period of time, over 100 years. We've had industrial sand mining for foundry work, for glass making, for water filtration systems and all of that.
So what's the difference?
And the main difference is that this is on a very, very different scale. Intensive mining, the surge, the sand boom in 5 years, now you have 105 mining sites and or processing sites. Sometimes the sand processing sites are right next to the mine.
And I heard in terms of not only the number that are currently operating, but the ones that have been applied for, you're up to 170 now.
Yeah, and it's to the point now where I believe Buffalo County has been so inundated that they've put, I'm not sure if it's officially a moratorium, but they're definitely trying to scale back the number that they can approve.
So we have sand mining, industrial sand mining, that's taking place in Wisconsin now on an unprecedented scale.
That's right. That's
and
right.
As an environmental ethicist,
right,
you're worried about how that's going to affect endangered species like the Karner blue butterfly, whose habitat just happens to be very coextensive with the areas where they're doing all the frac sand mining.
Yeah, and actually the counties in particular, you know, if you sort of do an overlay of a map and you put where is frac sand mining occur, and also where is the Cambrian, so what you need are Cambrian sandstone formations that have crystalline silica sand. And this is western, primarily western Wisconsin, but there's also a vein that sort of takes a turn through the center and sort of the northeastern
right.
part of the state. And if you look at the habitat, the high potentiality zone for where Karner blues exist, it's pretty much a map over that fits perfectly. Jackson
over
County,
Jackson
County. Monroe County, in particular, Juneau, Clark, Eau Claire. So these are just a few examples, but these are areas where these are ripe, already have frac sand at mines, and probably will have more, and or processing facilities.
Hold that thought. Dale Murray, professor of philosophy, environmental ethicist, who worries about the proliferation of frac sand mining, industrial sand mining on an unprecedented scale in Wisconsin, and how that will affect endangered species like the Karner blue butterfly. What do you think? What are the relative values of job creation and environmental protection? And how do you assess how something that hasn't even been measured will affect the habitat and affect the survival of an endangered species? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, building the local economy and strengthening the community by making local business everybody's business. More about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Our guest today, Dr. Dale Murray. He's a professor of philosophy and environmental ethicist UW Baraboo Sauk County. And he is speaking tonight, right after this show at 6:30 p.m. at the Center for Civic Engagement Theater, the UW Marathon County Campus, 625 Stewart Avenue, on the problems posed by frac sand mining in Wisconsin and their potential effects on endangered species, specifically the Karner blue butterfly. 1-800-780-9742 if this concerns you. 1-800-780-9742. And Dale, we've got a comment on our Facebook page from Brad. He read a report that mining frac sand hasn't resulted in many jobs. Can you comment on that and the dangers to workers and mine neighbors from inhaling frac sand? Here we're not talking about, well, we're talking about the effect on one species, human beings.
That's right. Yes. Thanks for that question. It's a very good one. And yeah, and actually I think I read a similar report in the Wausau Daily Herald. I'm sorry, I'm not from
that area.
So, okay. And actually that the job creation numbers, I think it was the Wisconsin Towns Association and a few other groups have been challenging the number of jobs that have been created. And it's interesting because not too long ago, I would say about 6 months to a year ago, there were two reports. One was an industry report, and the other was a non-industry report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. And they both reported that there would be likely the creation of between 2,300 and 2,800 jobs in frac sand mining. And now that part's being disputed. And I'm not so sure exactly where the numbers will end up being at the end of the day.
But it seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? I mean, if you've got 105 frac sand mines and maybe 170, it seems that there would be jobs that would go along with that.
Yeah, and I really haven't had a chance to corroborate any of those numbers. I mean, those two types of numbers. But I think that there has been, you know, I think that you always have to remember with all of this, it's how you're counting positions, I suppose, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think to a certain extent, we've even had a hard time sometimes identifying, you know, the numbers change even with the number of mines that are available and processing sites. But it's something to definitely keep an eye on, because if that's supposed to be the proof in the pudding for why it is that you're engaging in this practice, then you've certainly got to show at the end of the day that those jobs are being created. And not merely jobs being created, because, you know, frac sand mining could very well be a boom-bust economy, right?
Right.
So in other words, you have these jobs for a certain period of time. Right now, it looks like frac sand will continue to be extracted at a pretty strong rate, at least for the next 10 years, and probably longer. And the reason why is that the quality of the sand in Wisconsin is such high quality. But
High quality for the purpose of fracking.
Of
right?
fracking. And
what are they looking for?
Yeah, really good question. They're looking for really hard sand. That's probably the most important characteristic. Something that can withstand the pressure. It has a compression value of between around 6,000 pounds per square inch to 14,000 pounds per square inch. It has to be rounded, granular, and that's to allow for something that's really hard to be able to prop open the fractures that are created in the fracking process, but it has to be something where gas, natural gas, can still permeate through this sort of layer, you could see it as a series of pillars.
It's got to be the right shape and the right hardness.
It's like Goldilocks and the Three Bears in some ways.
So that's why
Wisconsin, just right.
That's why Wisconsin is the frac sand mine capital of the world. Just like, you know, and we're talking about the Karner blue butterfly, there are more Karner blue butterflies in Wisconsin than anywhere else in the country.
That's right.
So you've got these two things happening on the same geological terrain simultaneously.
Yeah, it's really fascinating from that standpoint. I think that also, you know, you have the largest metapopulations for Karner blue butterflies are in Wisconsin and western Michigan. And there isn't so much, I think if there's frac sand mining at all, fracking at all, in Michigan, it's in the Antrim Shale, which is in northern Michigan, if I remember properly.
Mm-hmm.
But still, you're talking about Wisconsin does have the highest population of Karner blues.
Now fracking involves taking chemicals, right? And
mm-hmm.
mixing it with good old Wisconsin sand and then pumping it down at a high pressure way below the water table so that you fracture the bedrock.
That's right.
And you free up this natural gas.
Yeah, it's a shale rock.
It's very controversial in the parts of the country where it occurs. Homeowners have claimed that it hurts their well water. Now, we've all seen pictures, I think, of the one gentleman who turns on his faucet and flames come out.
Right, right.
But the industry leaders say that fracking occurs far below the water tables.
Yeah, and there are a couple of things that can happen that could cause wells to be contaminated, even in the best possible scenario. So just to explain what happens, you drill a hole for a frack well. So, you know, municipal water wells, as I understand it, are usually maybe 650 to 1,000 feet deep. Frack sand mines are about a mile to a mile and a half deep. So you're going
about five times
exactly.
as far.
Exactly. And so, but here's what can happen though. You dig the well, you put in a metallic casing, and then you fill around it with concrete. So there's a casing around the top portion of the well. Some frack wells actually have the casing that goes all the way down to the bottom of the well, and then this is vital to a frack sand mine, to a fracking mine. You also have a horizontal axis that's cut across, mm-hmm. sort of like a tunnel that increases surface area.
It's L-shaped. Right. You go down
exactly.
and then you go across.
Exactly. And so you detonate charges to fracture the sand, and sometimes the casing actually goes into that area where the charges are detonated so that you try to keep as little fracking fluid from getting absorbed into the ground as possible. But here's the problem. The problem is when you have a blowout. And that's a possible phenomenon.
What's in this fracking fluid?
Well, there's a bit of a mystery with that.
They won't tell us, will they?
Yeah, it's looked upon as being... So some, you know, some... I've heard various descriptions, and some of the list of ingredients that I've seen have been as simple as dishwashing soap. And others more mysterious. And usually when... during congressional hearings, when representatives of fracking companies have been interviewed, they've been asked, "Well, what's in this in the fluid itself mm-hmm. beyond water and sand and dish soap?"
Yeah.
And the argument and the answer is, "Well, that's proprietary information." And so
but they're pumping it into the ground, and that's you know they
yeah,
don't
exactly.
own the ground. They don't own these resources. You
well,
would think they would have to reveal the information.
That's interesting. In the western part of the United States, what seems like a pretty common way that you would think about how it is that property rights work don't work that way. If you've heard of split estates, this is very mm-hmm. common in the West and fracking in Colorado and Wyoming, where you could own, you have your property, but you only own basically the topsoil and maybe down a bit, but the mineral rights underneath
are up for grabs and can be owned by private industry.
Exactly. So you could have a fracking well without your consent
underneath your property.
Exactly.
Now, if fracking itself is unethical, and that's certainly not something that I'm stating or implying, but it's a hypothetical. If it is, some people think it is, then wouldn't frack sand mining philosophically also be unethical because you're contributing to the process?
Yeah, that would seem to be the conclusion that I would draw as well. I mean, that seems, and then you have to say, how do you hold accountable, and exactly what does that mean to hold? So in other words, usually where you think that there's some wrongdoing, you want to find a character who's doing the wrongdoing, right? And you want to hold them accountable. And it's very interesting when you have a part of a process, how accountable do you want to hold those who are frack sand mining as opposed to fracking? That becomes a harder question to answer because it's a little bit further in distance from the problem
itself. Let's look at some of the benefits and some of the problems
right.
with frack sand mining. You've identified some of them, so let's go through them.
Sure.
One of the problems, noise pollution mm-hmm. might disturb endangered species and people living nearby.
Right. And noise pollution most likely, I mean, that's a very common problem that have been cited by folks who live next to both frack wells and also frack sand mines. That's right.
Light pollution as frack sand outfits mine at night as well as day.
Yeah, yeah. And fracking companies also often have 24/7 operations.
The land is left scarred and barren, according to some, although the companies are supposed to reclaim it, correct?
That's right. And so then that's a matter of enforcement, too, because, you know, you can have mine reclamation programs, and there have been successful ones in Wisconsin. So I don't want to, you know, I certainly don't want to steer it to the side of there's scarification of the land, and it will always remain that way. But remember, this is in reference to the Karner blue butterfly, right? So if you reclaim a mine 25 years after the damage has been done, it may be too late.
Too late for the butterfly.
For the butterfly.
All right, let's look at the benefits of fracking and frack sand mining. First of all, there's the natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
The natural gas is valuable. It's valuable for a number of reasons, but here's one. It's cleaner than coal, so it's possibly a bridge to even cleaner energies.
That's right. That's right. And it's interesting. I'm sure that folks have heard data as far as the amount of natural gas. I would even say a conservative estimate. I would say that there are, 204 trillion cubic feet of natural gas under U.S. soil. That, considering the consumption rate of 24 trillion cubic feet in the United States currently, mm-hmm. Now that could go up, of course, that leaves 92 years of energy source available.
And that's another thing. Domestic energy production, which makes us less reliant on foreign fuel sources, so it becomes a natural security issue.
That's right. That's right.
And then finally, we've got the jobs and the economic boon to depressed rural areas, which we've already talked about.
Sure. And it's understandable. I mean, it's understandable that you want to create jobs. You want to create jobs now. From my particular perspective, from a philosophical perspective, I like to look long range, and that's the worry, right? What are the long range consequences for
and are those
jobs
going to be long range?
Yeah, and
will the damage be long range as well?
And will the damage be long range?
Another break. Dale Murray, he's going to be speaking at UW Marathon County at the Center for Civic Engagement. About 45 minutes at 6:30 this evening on the philosophical and ethical implications of frack sand mining in Wisconsin and its impact on endangered species, including the Karner blue butterfly. 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to talk about the ethics of fracking and frack sand mining and the effects on endangered species like the Karner blue butterfly. We've got a question from Richard from Clam Lake, who says billions of gallons of water is used in the fracking process and gets polluted. That water is gone. What are the ethical implications of that?
Water usage is, as I see it, one of the next great issues that we're going to be facing environmentally. And there are worries about use of aquifers. And you know, initially you might just think of sort of local aquifers. If you're in a small town that doesn't have a great deal of water and you're using per frack, I can give you some figures. Depending upon the size of the frack, you can use 1 million to 7 million gallons per frack, and you might multiply frack a mine over mm-hmm. time. And the ethical implications of that in water use, you're going to see, I think, more conflict over water rights. You're already seeing it in the West, particularly in Wyoming and Colorado. And, you know, a capital venture or a venture capitalist might very well look to trying to accumulate water rights as sort of the next new economic boon. Maybe that's going a bit too far, but water is absolutely essential. And even if you don't contaminate the water, right, and maybe that's where this question is coming from, even if it's the case that you're not contaminating water,
you're using it
to the point where aquifers long term, you wonder if they're going to be able to sustain fracking and human population at the same time.
We're having problems from high capacity wells right now in the Plover area, the Golden Sands area, where You know, you have the Little Plover River drying up every year. You have some of the lakes going down because of industrial agriculture and
right.
municipal uses.
Right.
So if fracking uses all of that in an area where water isn't plentiful, and it is plentiful in Wisconsin, you can imagine how much that could deplete local water tables.
Certainly. And, you know, there's a worldwide shortage of water as well. Looking again at the long term, how we use our water is a very important issue.
Let's go to Brad in Plover, 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. Brad, you're on the air with Dale Murray.
Hi there. 3 days ago, there was a report released, published in the Central Wisconsin Business Journal, and the report cited that frac sand mining will have little impact on job mm-hmm. growth and job creation in western Wisconsin and central Wisconsin. And one thing that is never taken into account is the economic costs associated with frac sand mining. And the report raises a lot of questions, and I'm just wondering if the guest is aware of this report. It was produced by a group out of Montana, a consulting firm called Power Consulting Incorporated. And I guess it was a Wisconsin Farmers and Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minnesota, and the Wisconsin Towns Association are the folks that commissioned to have this report done.
Brad, thanks so much for the phone call. I think this was the same article that you saw in the Wausau Daily Herald referring to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, just a couple days ago, if I remember right, that it was actually in the Daily Herald. It may have been, the report may have been released a little before then. Yeah, I'm very much aware of this report. And this is very different from, I mentioned this earlier, but I'll mention it again, that the estimates that were coming in, and the interesting part about these estimates were that they came from both the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and also from frac sand industry reports, that there would be 2,300 to 2,800 jobs in frac sand mining. And whether or not these are long-term jobs is also a question, because, you know, you might actually have more jobs at the beginning when you're constructing frac sand mining because of that intense construction effort. Mm-hmm. And the types of jobs may change over time, too. I don't know how automated the system could be over time as well, and whether or not you'd get job losses. And from what I can see, it is a wait and see, sort of the proof is in the pudding at the end of the day. If the major argument for frac sand mining beyond sort of national security issues is job creation issues, so that locally you have a benefit. Then you're going to need to be able to show the evidence that you have increased those jobs.
Now you have a Wisconsin ethos of protecting the environment, but a lot of these fracking companies aren't from Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you have some that frac sand companies. You know, you have Badger Mining out of Berlin.
And Brad, thanks so much for the phone call.
Oh, thank you, Brad. Yes. Oh, sorry. But EOG is actually associated with Enron. It's actually out of Houston, Texas. Many frac sand, and this is understandable from this perspective, where is the infrastructure and where are the corporate offices of, well, fracking companies? Well, they're oil and natural gas companies. So a number of them are traditionally have drilled in areas of the South and West. And mm-hmm. So a number of those companies are going to be situated there. So that shouldn't be necessarily a surprise. But it does make you wonder this way, you know, and this is an argument that's often made, you might have some minimal local effect in job creation. And that's important to those people getting those jobs. I don't want to sell that short. But on the other hand, if the resources and the profits are mainly going outside of the state, you have to put that in your local cost-benefit analysis of how much that's really helping you.
Dale Murray, an environmental ethicist, professor of philosophy at UW-Baraboo Sauk County, talking about the impact of frac sand mining and its impact specifically on endangered species like the Karner blue butterfly. The habitat for the Karner blue butterfly is almost exactly where all the frack sand mining is going on in Wisconsin right now. We're going to take another short break. When we come back, we're going to talk a lot about the butterfly and what needs to be done in order to ensure its survival in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Dale Murray, professor of philosophy at UW-Baraboo Sauk County, is our guest today on Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. He will be speaking in just about 40 minutes, right across the hallway from us at the Center for Civic Engagement Theater on the UW-Marathon County campus, on the ethical questions involved with frack sand mining and protection of endangered species, specifically the Karner blue butterfly. Let's talk about the butterfly. There are more of them in Wisconsin than anywhere else. In fact, you could even say that they're not even really endangered in this state, at least not yet.
Yeah, and actually this is sort of a point of contention between the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. The Fish and Wildlife Service, when species are listed, it's not a listing that's contingent so much on small areas. So in other words, the state of Wisconsin, they don't do the listing in this way, where the state of Wisconsin, the species is not endangered here, but it's endangered in Michigan. And so, but on the other hand, here's the point of contention. Wisconsin DNR is well aware of that kind of strategy. On the other hand, the way that regulatory burdens are placed, it seems as though to the Wisconsin DNR, and I think justifiably so, that for all of the good work that's been done in keeping the species from declining in this state, because there's the largest metapopulation in this state, and we have a habitat conservation plan that exists.
Let's talk about that. We've got the Habitat Conservation Plan. That's the way the Endangered Species Act works now, right?
That's right.
It's no longer like it used to be. You referred to it as a pit bull in some of your writing. It's no longer the kind of thing where if you take one endangered species, one individual
member
and kill it,
right.
You're going to face substantial, serious penalties. Right now, the whole focus is on protecting the habitat so that
that's right.
If you take away the habitat somewhere, you've got to restore it somewhere else.
That's right. And
and the habitat for the Karner blue butterfly, it's very special because they only live on wild lupine.
Yes.
You know, they need this one plant, this one flowering plant in order to survive.
The larvae depend upon it. It's its exclusive food source. So if there are no wild lupine, then you're not going to be able to sustain this species. And actually, traditionally, with the habitat conservation plan that exists, what this allows for is incidental take. And what incidental take means is that if you have foreseen but unintentional taking or mm-hmm. killing of an individual member of a species, if you have a habitat conservation plan that has been cleared with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you can establish over a certain geographical area an agreement that you can take individual members without legal liability just so long as you're either buying additional acreage or you're setting aside certain acreage from any industrial or agricultural purpose, at least any purpose that would risk taking those individual species that are under the agreement.
The statewide habitat conservation plan for the Karner blues was implemented in 1999, and this was an agreement between the DNR, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and several paper companies.
That's right.
And it took a long time for that agreement to get hammered out.
It did. It took a long period of time. And actually, I think that the initial contact from the paper companies with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was actually in 1992. So it did. And of course, this was a very new change to the law. HCPs do not take that long to establish anymore.
But the paper industry, which has been around a lot longer than the frack sand mining industry in Wisconsin, They played by the rules.
They did.
They waited 7 years.
They waited 7 years. They put in a lot of time and treasure.
So how do they feel now after waiting 7 years and playing by the rules and getting this habitat conservation plan drawn up, and now you've got these frac sand miners who, it's a boom industry, and they're just going ahead willy-nilly and doing it without... without going through the same process that the paper companies went through.
Yeah, I think they have a claim to unfairness. If you've gone through this process and you've played by the rules, and you now have, now this part of this may very well be a situation where frac sand companies don't necessarily know much about the Karner blue butterfly. That's possible. It's also possible that they really don't understand the HCP process. On the other hand, you might say the same for, international paper company as well that has offices in lots of different areas, I'm sure as well. That they, maybe in 1992 they were in the same place. But they came to the table and they recognized, and maybe they were just long-term economic goals. You know, it could have been that they recognized that we don't want lawsuits later. This is a prudential way of going about our industry.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing to bear in mind is that if you're not under the HCP, in other words, if you haven't come on and signed
the Habitat Conservation Plan,
the HCP. Habitat Conservation Plan, that if you do take an individual member of a species, that you are violating the Endangered Species Act.
Why is the Karner blue butterfly so significant? Does it have a special significance for our environment?
I think it has a special significance for our environment as being, I suppose one of the ways that you could think of it is the community has really, I think, embraced in number, Black River Falls, for example, has the
Karner blue butterfly.
Yes, and they have
but
an annual.
Now you're coming down to the,
that's right.
the crass, as
sure.
I described it, equation. It's good for tourism, therefore
right.
We want to protect it, which
so,
is an economic analysis.
So beyond that, though, as you mentioned earlier, the bird watchers, right? I mean, there are people who do enjoy this very, it's a very beautiful butterfly, and not just for the matter of bringing more tourists in and just seeing it as fitting within a greater ecosystem.
And that's what John Muir said about ecosystems. He said, you pull any thread and the whole thing unravels. So every part of the ecosystem is just as important as every other part because it's a whole. It's interrelated.
That's right. And sometimes you can't always see the impact of an extinct species until, who knows, years after the matter.
And you're worried that we haven't done any real studies on the impact of frac sand mining, and by the time we get those studies done, it may be too late for the butterfly.
Yeah, I do have that worry. And I think that it may very well be that there isn't that much. Now, it could be that there isn't that much of an impact, and we'll find that out. But you can't do that without properly making sure that you have an audit, an inventory of
doing
the
science.
That's right.
Doing the research, the empirical evidence gathering.
That's right. And that isn't going to happen if you just simply start mining.
Let's wrap this up, and we're down to our last few seconds. The precautionary principle, go slow in the face of uncertainty.
Yeah, I think so. I think that if you are trying to gather evidence, look, my lack of evidence of a problem for the Karner blue butterfly does not constitute that there's no problem for the Karner blue butterfly. That's why you study the problem.
Dale Murray, professor of philosophy at UW-Baraboo Sauk County and UW-Richland, and he will be speaking in just a half hour at the Center for Civic Engagement Theater, UW-Marathon County. It's sponsored by WIPS, the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service, our partners here at Wisconsin Public Radio in Wausau, and it is free, and you will learn something if you attend it. Thank you very much, Dale Murray. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer and our on-air producer, Rick Ryer. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Next week on Route 51, we look at regional breweries in north-central Wisconsin, breweries that have made it big, breweries that are growing bigger, and breweries that are just starting up. One of our guests is John Zappa, who is one of the leaders of the Stevens Point Brewery. So that's next week, next Thursday at 5 on Route 51. Thanks again for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we are heading out of town.